on this episode of Edge of the Web.
It turns out that anything important requires lots of people. And I think this applies just as much to business and marketing as it does to, you know, society and families and all that. If it's important, we can't do it on our own. This becomes this great paradox. So we need each other, but we suck together.
Your weekly digital marketing trends with industry trend-setting guests. You're listening and watching Edge of the Web. Winners of Best Podcast from the Content Marketing Institute for 2017. Hear and see more at edgeofthewebradio.com. Now, alongside Tom Broadbeck, here's your host, Aaron Sparks.
Welcome back to The Edge. Hey, for all of our listeners on podcast as well as our live cast audience, thanks for joining us. Every week we're broadcasting from Edge Media Studios located in downtown Indianapolis, Indiana. Every week we bring you the latest trends in digital marketing and marketing influencers from around the world. Very blessed to be able to have this show and the type of guests that can really contribute into demystifying digital marketing tactics, and as well as key concepts in entrepreneurial development and team building as of today. I mean, there's a great number of topics that we cover each and every week. So you want to check out all the shows and all the guests that we've had on the show over at edgeofthewebradio.com. I'm your host, Aaron Sparks. I'm the CEO of Site Strategics as well as Edge Media Studios. And on top of that, to my left, we actually have Tom Broadbeck, who's the director of digital media. Sir, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good to have you back in the seat there.
You know, I'm glad to be back.
Do I scare you off sometimes?
Sometimes so you do.
You just jump behind the glass?
Yeah. It's the BO, so I just need to keep the glass in between us. So
it is completely self-contained. The fan
helps. So
really? Fantastic.
Just kidding.
Oh, my kids tell me that I stink, but for a whole different reason. And so, hey, well, you know what doesn't stink? Actually, Site Strategics. The entire show is powered by Site Strategics. Basically, we are an agile digital marketing strategy and execution firm located in Indianapolis, Indiana. And if you want to learn more about what the agile marketing methodology is, it's results-driven, nimble marketing to be able to focus on your bottom line. That's what Agile is all about. So we certainly implore you to go over to Site Strategics. That's S-I-T-E, strategics.com. You go check us out and contact us. So let's schedule a time to talk about your potential online success. That's who we are. Let's introduce our guest on the show, Shane Snow, founder at large at Contently. Shane, how are we doing today?
Hey, I'm doing great. Nice to be on your column. I mean, show.
Ah, see? Thank you. Thank you so much, Shane. Appreciate it. You're out of the gate already.
I was going to say column. Doesn't sound like column. Yeah.
What do we have in column? They're in the throat. I mean, Brittany did have malaria, so I don't know if there's anything on the mic.
Oh, my God.
She's taking our director of marketing services is literally taking medicine that could be used for malaria. It says there on the bottle. So we actually have some tsetse flies that evidently fly into Site Strategics.
I'm glad I'm not in the studio, but it's lovely to see you guys.
Yeah, BO malaria right here at the Edge.
It's a good tagline.
Absolutely. Well, Shane, we love to deep dive into an interview with you, but first we got some news. Would you like to contribute in the news space?
Yeah, let's go for it.
All right, so let's take you through the latest digital marketing news.
I was very excited to start my reportings.
This week's trending topics.
All right, so with the trending topics that we have from Google, the Google by Ryan Weber, think macro, record actions in Google Sheets to skip repetitive work. Now, you remember the macros in Word or Microsoft Word, right?
Sure.
I mean, in fact, way before the internet, I was working with a guy who wanted to build macros into Word to be able to tour real estate pictures. This was like pre-internet posting. It was crazy nuts. But hey, what's this blog all about coming from Google?
Yeah, so Google just announced some updates. I figured this might be helpful for some of the SEOs that we have listening to the show that have a lot of spreadsheets, a lot of data that they work with frequently. So now they're introducing macros. So if you don't know what a macro is,
awesome.
It's a way for you to record steps of a sequence of what you're doing.
Yep.
And so then you don't have to do it every time that you're going into a spreadsheet. So if you need to sort data, Noah, you could play out the video there you wanted to right there in the middle and kind of show people kind of what a macro is. Just if you we use it a lot for Photoshop.
We
had
absolutely.
To do batch
different batch, actions. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's great for people who have a lot of data that they export and put into a spreadsheet, and then they have to sort it, and they have to do so. Here it's just recording the steps mm-hmm. of what they're doing. They color coded it and sorting it here by highest priority and created a chart. And so now, with just a click of a button, since it's been recorded as a macro, it could be done in an instant.
That is too cool. What a neat advancement. I mean, getting closer and closer to rivaling Word in the entire Office suite with these type of functionalities.
Sure. Yeah,
Shane, do you macro?
You know, one time I took an online class in college, and it required you to sit a certain number, like 42 hours inside this online class. And so I recorded a macro to sit in the class and to move, click around through the for a while. And then I took the test and I passed. So macros can be used for anything.
It's genius.
But officially, Edge of the Web does not recommend that for students going through their college courses.
But if you thought of that, I'm not sure
that
what the course
be an
was.
A in its own yeah. Yeah.
My mom said I could do anything I wanted with my life, and what I didn't want to do was sit for 42 hours in that class. So.
Amen. Too funny. So it's good to see those type of tools, and you know the Google Suite certainly has been bereft of some. Common functionality that's been around the Office documentation for a while. So good to see that the sheets have been kind of bare, and good to see some new functionality coming in there. From TechCrunch, from Romain Dillett. That's a name for you. TechCrunch is saying Google is about to launch a Gmail web redesign, y'all. Kind of interesting that they've been making changes, minor changes over the time, but they sent an email to Google G Suite customers to tell them that the company has been working on a brand new version of Gmail for the web. In addition to a fresh design, the company also listed some of the new features. You can expect to be able to access Google Calendar from the Gmail interface directly. Outlook customers are probably going to love this. You're also going to be able to snooze emails so they reappear in your inbox hours or days later. I don't know about that. If I hit snooze on an email,
you're not going.
I'm not. Where the hell did this come from? I mean, the flood of emails that I get on a regular basis, sure. And it's I'm not that popular. I just get a lot of crap. And yeah. And if you're hitting snooze all the time, right?
Yeah. Well, you need to sign up for all those free newsletter. Get a free ice cream coupon.
Get a free ice cream.
For all for your birthday.
It's peanut butter. Maybe. It's peanut butter.
Okay.
Well, it's a good way to clean your inbox out if you can't reply to a specific email just yet. So literally, hold on. So you're hitting snooze on somebody who's sending you an email.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole concept of instantaneous communication, right? Now, we also know that emails can be tracked. HubSpot sends some trackable code, right? So you could literally open it up, signal to the sender that they've just opened it, and then hit snooze. And that sender's thinking that, okay, they got it. I'm waiting to respond. Clock's ticking. Tick, tick, tick. All the while, they're in a snooze button.
Sure. But they could also have opened it up and hit delete.
No, they could have. You just don't know.
Say the same thing.
It's going to be psychological havoc on people, I think.
It's thinking.
You send a text message, and you see it's red, and then you wait a day, and they don't reply. I mean, that's, you know, that's painful.
That's messing with somebody's head right there.
Yeah, I think both of these are actually examples of something that's pretty cool, which is Google has had this, you know, ecosystem of, you know, third-party apps and plugins and Chrome extensions and mm-hmm. things you can use to kind of, you know, make, you know, Google Sheets mimic Microsoft functionality. Or, you know, I spent a lot of time on planes. I just downloaded added a Chrome add-on to help me, to allow me to access my Gmail emails offline. All this stuff being supported natively in Google is very smart of them. So they've probably used data, actually, like any good, you know, marketer should, at what kinds of plugins people are using, how people are hacking these products, and now they're supporting them officially, which makes them work even better. So I think there's kind of a meta lesson in there that you can actually drive product development in the same way that you drive kind of marketing campaigns.
Absolutely, yeah. And part of the article, and that's what you're referencing, is Google's actually working on a new way to store your emails on your computer for offline access as the company's slowly phasing out Chrome apps, right? The Google will now actually be using standard web technologies to let your browser store that data. That's fantastic. So can't wait. I got my email about it a couple days ago, actually. So I was excited. It's those little things in life. Lastly on the docket, marketing land. What's the future of consumer data now that Facebook is pulling back? So Ryan Phelan put out this article. Tom, what's that all about?
Yeah, so I just kind of wanted to bring it up and kind of get Shane's thoughts on the whole Facebook thing. We've talked about it a couple times the show this week, but he had some nice points he wanted to talk about here. He says three changes for the Facebook data issue that should inspire. He says, one, consumers won't delete their data or leave Facebook, but they will respond to transparency. Mm-hmm. Two, consumers must recognize their culpability. And then the third point he made was consumers must keep their heat on data. So, I just kind of want to get Shane's thoughts of now that Zuckerberg's been in front of Congress for 2 days.
Hmm.
Right? 2 days? I think it's 2 days. Yeah.
He went through that unscathed, didn't he?
Yeah.
Sorry, Shane. Go ahead.
You know, I think that this piece was interesting because it sort of defends Facebook in a way, and it also predicts that, you know, Facebook is going to, you know, get out of jail free a little bit, and says that, you know, a lot of the onus is on us as users and consumers, which I think is a good point.
Yep, absolutely.
I think the counterpoint is that most of the people in my life that are not in the tech industry or in online business are not they're not in the know about a lot of this stuff that, you know, people are surprised by how much data, you know, companies like Facebook collect on them and how much data Facebook buys from third parties. And, you know, they have these sort of shadow profiles of people who have quit and all that. The regular average person doesn't know that. They don't know that that's the price of, you know, using Facebook, using this great tool. And I think also there is, you know, this element of we're a little bit held hostage by the monopoly of Facebook in a way where, you know, if you don't have a Facebook account, it actually is detrimental to your work, especially if you're marketing, but also, you know, to keeping up with family and friends, because it's the only one and it's so centralized. There's a little bit of a, yes, we're culpable for, you know, our own data or whatever, but we kind of have to do it. Otherwise, you're sort of left out. So I think that's part of the debate that, you know, I would love to see the author respond to, but I think he makes good points because we do just sort of demonize, you know, the big, successful, scary company that's just, you know, spent 14 years mishandling our data and apologizing. They're, one of my favorite articles I've read in the last week is a Wired magazine article that chronicled Facebook's 14-year apology tour of every time something like this happens, they apologize. And, you know, how many times Mark Zuckerberg has said, we screwed up, and it's like every time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I do think that that's a problem, but it's also kind of on us for doing business. And not, you know, his third point is we need to hold, you know, these platforms' feet to the fire. We need to, you know, and to mix the metaphors, vote with our feet. So, you know, there's a symbiotic relationship we have with these platforms. They need us as the users and consumers. We need them as people who do business on these platforms and connect with, you know, the people in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
But we need the information asymmetry to go away, so that we can decide how we're going to vote, how we're going to be users, and not kind of be blind users in the dark,
right,
only to find out years later that, oh, hey, all this has been going on.
Well, you also have the very, very good points. You also have the perspective of this is brand new for our age, our society. We are now... new media audience players, right? There we have now a new transaction, a new economy, basically, which it is our data, right? And there's a maturation of society, and you got a bell curve of people that know it, you know, and know exactly what they're transacting and also accept that. Mm-hmm. But you also have the marginal entry points and the digital immersion you're getting deep, larger and larger, and the demographic breakdown is getting wider and wider, right? So there's this maturation of just understanding this environment. And all the while, I mean, if you look at it, Facebook was playing by the conventional rules of their user documentation, their user licensing. It was all right there. We just didn't have the time to read it. And on top of that, I mean, it's a 15-page 200-page, whatever the legalese document. It was contrived in convention, right? If you look at Apple's user engagement, the thing's huge as well. Every platform in which you're utilizing software and data, if you don't read through it, who's it on? To be honest with you.
Yeah, I think that's, and that's a meta problem.
Yeah,
right?
It is.
Like we are in the habit now, and you can actually sue for having too confused, if you're too confused by, the terms of the agreement or whatever. There's lawsuits that happen about that, but we're just trained to just, click sign and click I agree. And that's not good. I do think that that a company like Facebook at this point, they've basically been just the most clever of every company that would have done what they do, right? And at this point, I think that if they're serious about the mission that they keep talking about over the last couple of years of connecting the world and making the world better, then they need to get serious about making sure that us dum-dums understand what is going on and that we can participate in this mission with them rather than, it being okay for us to just kind of not know until it gets the best of us. And so, I think like they could help us to understand a little bit better before the fact rather than after the fact when there are, are things that will affect us and we can do a little bit more of our homework. So I think it's a responsibility on both sides.
Yeah, there absolutely is. And I'll completely agree with you. There's an ownership on the SaaS companies and these platforms to come closer to standardizing and making more common the understanding of the engagement. Right. They own that. But I keep on going back to the excuses that I hear on talk radio. And what's really interesting is that the people that know they use these platforms, that they're just astonished that there's data there that could be used to market to them, but they love being marketed to. So which is it? I mean, if you're wanting to go off the grid, go off the grid. Fine, cool. If you're wanting this type of valuable commerce and intuitive commerce, it comes with data analysis. I guarantee you that Google, in all of its glory, is wiping the sweat off its brow because they are collecting that much data, if not more data, about users and being able to push that mashup of very valuable search result content into your lap whenever you're interacting with that platform. I mean, Facebook's taking the heat, but there's a heck of a lot of other players out there, right?
I think that's a good point. I have a very, very mixed feelings about Facebook. I would criticize them for the way they've gone about it, but they're not doing... You're exactly right. They're not doing anything fundamentally different than what Google, Snap, any other company that we're using as this kind of platform is doing. I think that Facebook has gone about it in kind of the more scummier way at times, if I can say that.
Yep, you can.
But the other thing I'll say is, so I killed my Facebook account 4 years ago because I was uncomfortable with and being in this industry, I know a little bit more than say my father does about his Facebook account. But I killed my Facebook account, and the social media manager at my company created a Facebook page for me because I don't exist if I don't have a Facebook account. But I kept my Instagram, and I've noticed that the ads in my Instagram, they're the only ads I click on. I've bought so many pairs of shoes from Instagram because they know that I read GQ every day, and like they're somehow tracking the things that I'm clicking and liking and all that, and. But they show me ads that are actually relevant that I don't mind having as the price for Instagram. And part of what I like about that, and I think it's kind of the point you're getting at, like I'd rather those ads than other ads if it's going to be free. But part of I think what I like about it is Instagram is kind of this niche activity that I do. It's not my whole life and environment. Unlike Google, with all the things we just talked about, right? Google is my email and my schedule and my calendar and my social network and my contact list and all this, and my search engine. Unlike that, Instagram is just looking at photos of friends and family members and, fashion bloggers that I follow.
Right.
And that's it. And so I get ads that are just down the center of that, and it's great. And I think that that's I don't know. I don't know if there's a prediction there, but
I think you're actually on to it. And just to kind of to codify that, I think the transaction is allow the consumers what categories of data that they want to be marketed to, right? And if I want to turn off the political marketing tally on that, I can, and I'll get regular content, not spun or targeted content based on my profile. If you allow the consumers to manage their own data profile of what they want to be marketed to, just like Shane was talking about, right? Then I don't.
Conversion rates will go up. You know, sure. If I'm only shown ads that I've opted into the categories of, there's still serendipity, right? Companies that I don't know about can still reach me, but I'm going to click on those more. I'm going to buy those more. I'm going to become, you know, a follower and hopefully engage with their content more than I will getting these random dumb ads from political action committees and, you know, as seen on TV products I don't care about.
Exactly. I think we have come to a compromise. Here on the show, we have Facebook, you just got to listen to us, right? Here on the show, we found a place where consumers can meet the marketing big data giants right here.
There we go. I want every as seen on TV ad. You seen the one with the egg in the microwave?
Okay,
make your hard-boiled eggs?
I've got one.
Or you, not in the microwave, you hard-boiled egg. You crack the egg, and then you boil that, and then it just pours out of the egg.
I want a ShamWow myself.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I love ShamWows. Can't get enough of them.
Cool. Good to know.
You know what?
Your birthday's coming up, right?
Yeah. Absolute crap. Well, you know what won't use your data for anything but good? That's the Edge of the Web newsletter. So if you want to sign up today, just text to the number, not when you're driving, 22828, the word Edge Talk right there on the screen, and you'll be able to sign up right there for our newsletter or go over to edgeofthewebradio.com. What you'll receive is a synopsis of our last guest who we talked to, what we talked about, and where we got off the rails, right, which is kind of usual. On top of that, some news items, nuggets of gold coming out of Tom's computer over here on a regular basis. And on top of that, who we're going to be talking to next. And who knows, a kind of a hidden Easter egg of sorts every once in a while. So, again, we won't use that information for anything else but sending you that email. But we certainly would appreciate feedback and let us know how we're doing on the show. So just go over to edgeofthewebradio.com. Submit right there on – don't submit. Sign up today. All right. Follow all the featured trending topics over at edgeofthewebradio.com. Now let's deep dive with this week's featured guest.
Now it's time for Edge of the Web featured interview with Shane Snow, author of the book, The Storytelling Edge.
Well, Shane, you had the deep voice guy giving you the intro there. How about that?
I love it. I'm working on that. I won't debut with this show, but you know, maybe.
You just have to come around and when you're prepared, okay. So for our audience, let me introduce Shane. Shane is an award-winning journalist, celebrated entrepreneur, and best-selling author of Smart Cuts and the upcoming book called Dream Teams. That's going to be out in June, as well as a co-author of The Storytelling Edge. Love the title. He is also a co-founder of Contently, which helps creative people and companies tell great stories together. Shane, welcome to the show again. Why don't you unpack your backstory the way you can tell it?
All right. So I grew up in a small town in Idaho, and my father was an engineer. And so I grew up taking things apart and being really interested in science and kind of these stories of, you know, scientists from all of these different parts of the world coming together to, you know, make the future. And so basically I was a nerd, and I really loved stories. Because my other parent, my mother, was very clever. And I had this brother who I hated. He was a year and 3 months younger than me. He's taller than me. And, you know, he's a little twerp. I would dare a
jerk. He's a tall twerp.
Yeah. And so we competed over everything. And my mother, being very clever, decided that the way to get us to shut up and to stop and to sort of channel this competition into something positive is she orchestrated basically who can read the most books contest that never ended. And so since a really young age, since I could learn to read, as my brother could learn to read, I read hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books. And so I basically grew up to be a nerd who loves writing and who loves stories. And, you know, went to college. I got through some online classes. And then I went to journalism school.
We know how you got through those online credits. Games up.
I went to journalism school to write about business and science and tech. And along the way, kind of funded my education by doing online. First, I actually interned at a pay-per-click management company. So doing online marketing and online programming. And basically then wanted to write about that. And that sort of accidentally turned into co-founding this company Contently about 8 years ago now, which turned into a content marketing platform. So helping brands not only connect with journalists and photographers to hire them out as freelancers to create content for them, but also project management and analytics and this whole sort of suite of tools.
Mm-hmm.
And so kind of accidentally became a businessman and leader of a giant team. And throughout this whole journey, I've used journalism and writing and stories as an excuse to learn how to get better at these things. First at building an innovative company, and then at running teams and learning how to collaborate better. When my role went from the guy who does stuff to the guy who helps other people do stuff, and so that's basically the subject of the two books that you mentioned. Smart Cuts is about innovation,
mm-hmm,
and lateral thinking, and Dream Teams, which is coming out this June, is about the psychology and neuroscience of human collaboration. And then in the process, since Contently is all about stories and content, co-wrote a book based on 7 years of lessons with our editor-in-chief, and that's The Storytelling Edge, which we named after you guys, actually. I
was wondering. That's so flattering, sir. I completely appreciate it. I want to get into the concept of storytelling and marketing. Those are some great core components, but if you indulge me, I want to make sure we recognize the title sponsor real quick. Site Strategics is the proud sponsor of the title sponsor of and the title sponsor of Edge of the Web, and wanted to share with its listeners a special offer. We provide digital marketing strategies to our clients regularly, and we are constantly asked about the question about return on investment. And truly, that's what you're interested in with any marketing firm, right? Well, would you like to discover your marketing ROI? Why not have a second opinion to check out how your investment is paying off? We're offering a 30% discount off of our digital marketing ROI report. Learn your digital strengths, weaknesses, and threats. The report delivers a comprehensive image of the existing performance of your company in the areas of SEO, content, social media, and SEM, while allowing the Site Strategics production team full insight in the areas of opportunity and growth. SEO audits, social media review, paid marketing review, conversion analysis, competitor analysis as well as gap analysis. So go on over to the URL offer. We actually have it out, edgeofthewebradio.com/ROI. Easy enough to get there, and you can jump right in and be able to just sign up today, discover your ROI, and get the conversation going with us, and we'll be able to find whether this is a good match for what you're trying to do. So, Shane, thanks for us taking over the lane here real quick. But this is about you, man, and we certainly want to make sure that we dive into understanding storytelling, but more importantly, creating dream teams, man. Let's hear about this book. It's coming up in June, so lay it on us. Give us the inspiration behind it.
So the story behind the inspiration actually harkens back to my dad's engineering job. So I grew up in a small town in Idaho, which is in the middle of the desert, where there's a giant nuclear test reactor that my dad worked at. And so I grew up with
this is like
great
the beginning of like a superhero movie, right?
Kinda, yeah. And then I fell into this vat of green stuff. So I grew up with this storyline that about how nuclear power was going to change the world, and how, all it released was steam. My dad's job was actually to design the canisters that they hold the spent nuclear fuel. So the radioactive stuff that they throw away, his job was to take care of that. And then all they release is steam into the atmosphere. And, I grew up with the story that this was going to change the world. And it has in a lot of places. And also the story about, all the Russian and American and German and Swedish and New Zealand scientists, men and women, young and old, that came together to help us create this this thing. And it wasn't too many years ago, as I was building my company and transitioning from that role as, the guy who does stuff to the guy who leads the team. And I'm thinking about, getting these people who appear to be so brilliant and talented to stop fighting and to like, you know, to be better than the sum of their parts, and just realizing the more of us there were, the harder it was, and just kind of the more conflict there was. I'm thinking about this. I'm at this lecture, this science lecture, and the scientist is giving this talk about who's going to kill us first, the robots or the aliens. Yeah. And yeah, it's at this thing called Nerd Night, and you know, it's funny lectures, and but he's going through this real research, and you know, he concludes the robots are going to get here before the aliens do. So he gets off the stage, and I grab him. I'm a journalist, so you know, I'm going to ask the hard hitting questions. I grab him, and I'm like, hey, wouldn't any aliens that show up actually be killed by their own robots before they got to us? And he said, yeah, of course, that would definitely happen, but. But don't worry, because we're going to blow ourselves up with nukes long before either of those. And then the dude walks away, leaving me thinking about this like he's so sure about this. So I look this guy up, and it turns out he's the head of the Global Catastrophic Risk Institute, whose job is to brief the United Nations on what could destroy humanity. So the guy whose job is to know these things just casually says we're going to blow ourselves up with the same thing that my dad helped you know, design canisters for, and that put food on the table, and that I thought was going to change the world. So I kind of had this sort of existential freak out. And I saw in this sort of a meta analogy for what was going on in my own company and kind of in the world in general, it's that, you know, just like little atoms crashing together make heat and electricity, and all these different people had to crash together to make that technology. Humans, when they come together, we want to use that technology to blow ourselves, blow each other up, right? Mm. And humans that come together to work on these kinds of things so often devolve into fighting and chaos or sort of stalling out. And so I started getting really obsessed with just kind of that idea. And when you look at the research, it turns out that most groups, almost all groups, not all, but most groups are less efficient, less productive, and less smart and creative than most individuals are, which sucks. So when we come together, it's just like we get dragged down. Even
that's depressing,
right? Yeah, and like brainstorming research shows very clearly that we will come up with better ideas in our own bedroom by ourselves than we will in a group of people. Same people, just as smart. In a group, we're less creative. And you kind of see this in any group project you had in school or any company that you're building. You know, the bigger the project gets, just the harder it is. And it turns out that anything important requires lots of people. And I think this applies just as much to business and marketing as it does to, you know, society and families and all that. If it's important, we can't do it on our own. You know, you can't clean the stadium for the next game with one person, just like you can't invent, you know, life-saving technology to save kids in a hospital with one person. Mm. So this becomes this great paradox that we need each other, but we suck together. But it turns out that, and I dare say that perhaps the two of you experience this on a, you know, a weekly basis. Sometimes we have teams and we have teamwork that just defies all of that, where things click, where you're more than the sum of your parts, when you feed off of each other's energy and ideas and differences. And that's how we actually, you know, create the future. And so I wanted to study what makes a difference between, you know, humans that come together and break down and humans that come together and break through. So that became the basis for this book. And the way it connects to the storytelling edge and to Contently and all that, aside from just, I think, business lessons, and these lessons are good meta lessons for any work that we're doing, including marketing, it's that one of the best ways that you can build relationships with people who are not like you, who you need on your team or who need to help you in your journey for whatever you're doing, especially things that are important, is through storytelling. And that stories have this amazing power that's built into our biology, that's you know, neuroscientific, for building empathy between people, for getting us to feel connected, which is coincidentally what businesses want to do with marketing. They want to build relationships and make people care. But storytelling has been used to rally people together in every great social movement we've ever seen, every great cause that people have supported, and any great breakthrough, groundbreaking company. You know, we rally the people we need in order to do the work we were meant to do, not by showing PowerPoint slides with statistics, not by, you know, putting the sales pitch out for why this is important, not by begging for money, but by telling the story of the woman who wouldn't give up her seat on the bus, We're telling the story of how we're going to make human life multiplanetary, and that's why we're building this rocket company to go to Mars, so we can save the human race. Those are the kinds of things that get the best people in the world to join our cause and help us change things. So that's kind of the connection. But it turns out that the stories of amazing teams in history are completely fascinating, and the lessons you can learn from them, the psychology of what makes collaborations really work, are fairly counterintuitive. And so I've, over the last few years, been workshopping what I've been researching and learning here at Contently, and even in our own kind of marketing efforts. And, you know, any marketing effort is going to require a team. And guess what? You're going to have better ideas and better programs if you work together than if you work alone, if you work together the right way. Otherwise, the team of one is going to be more clever than the team of five. So anyway, that's kind of the ramble, but I've been obsessed with this over the last little bit. And I think it's kind of the missing thing in a lot of our discussion around business is that, you know, we need to look these kinds of paradoxes in the face and not just try and do things the way that we've always done them, or accept, you know, endure the lost right. productivity that's necessary, endure that, you know, the way things have to be done are this way. But we can actually make a much bigger difference if we, I guess, pay attention to these kinds of things.
But and I appreciate that insight. It kind of sets the stage for the entire book, and I appreciate that deep dive that you're taking there. But what you're talking is about, if I could come along sideways into this, you're talking about inspiration as opposed to maybe efficiencies in project management, because I mean, there is certainly a use of project management in tools to help get things better, right, and be able to deliver more efficient results. But at the same time, you're talking about lighting up people's interests with storytelling, and that's not an efficiency. That's cause oriented, right?
Yeah, So what it's about is problem solving. You know, if you have an assembly line that you want to operate and you don't want to change that. Mm-hmm. Then you need efficiency, you need uniformity. You know, if you want to be the redcoats, right, in the Revolutionary War, you want people who are exactly the same with the same uniform marching in a straight line.
Yeah, I wouldn't pick that team.
Yeah. But if you want to do things better, if you're trying to invent a new process, a better way of fighting that battle, or a better way of, you know, designing the assembly line or machine, then you're going to need collaboration. Yeah. You're going to need a different kind of collaboration than we're used to. So I think that actually this, and marketing is really interesting. And one of the things that I think about a lot is we play this game of sort of escalating, you know, follow the leader, where someone discovers or invents or creates, and often because they've combined different people and points of view, and, you know, some group discovers this better way of doing things. And then that becomes this thought leadership that becomes a tactic. And people follow that thought leadership, and we jump in and we do it. You can think, you know, anything from, you know, email to Facebook ads to SEO to anything.
Mm-hmm.
And sub-tactics inside of those. Someone discovers what works, thought leadership, people follow, and then it gets bastardized. Or it just becomes the thing. We reach an equilibrium where everyone's doing it, and so it's no longer as effective. And then someone comes up with a new thing. And, you know, it's either a gimmick or it's real. And if it's real, then the thought leadership lasts and people follow that. And we just play this game over and over again. It's like computer hackers fighting each other, you know? It's like you figure out a new way to get in and then people patch it up.
Yep.
And you figure out a new way to get in and you're trying to do that.
It's like parenting with teens, by the way. there's my analogy.
So I think that's where this is important is yes, efficiency is great if you're trying to operate something that you don't want to change.
Right.
But if you're trying to be innovative or breakthrough or solve new and important problems, then that's when the teamwork thing really starts to matter.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you actually referenced a number of different groups in your analogies and your research for the book. Now, you talk about rap groups, pirate gangs, sports teams, and more. What all these disparate groups have commonality. So unpack that for briefly, if you would.
Sure. Well, you're going to have to read the book to, you know, find out it.
Dude!
But first, you need to go to Site Strategics. So, and actually, like, I was going
to try to dig yourself out of that. Come on.
I was going to say, I really like, you know, when we were going through their ROI thing, we have this whole thing that this kick we've been on at Contently all last year about accountable content that,
oh, wow.
You know, content marketing being the buzzword, you know, du jour. Mm-hmm. Too many people are doing it in that sort of follower way and not having it be accountable to ROI. So I like what I saw there.
Cool.
That's like strategic.
Thank you.
Anyway, so all these groups. So I went on this tour of history looking at underdog teams that, you know, beat odds, or, you know, teams that changed the world and what they have in common. And a lot of the things they do are very counterintuitive. So I'll give one example, the rap groups. So, excuse me, one second.
Man, I was really hoping on the pirate gangs.
We can talk about pirate gangs. You know,
let's do pirate gangs, man.
All right, let's talk about pirate gangs. Okay. So this is, I think, a movie that needs to be made, is the story of the time when the pirates, the Choctaw warriors, the free slaves, and a pack of lawyers and local whores from New Orleans saved America from destruction.
Is that like the beginning of a joke? No. And they all walk into a bar. All right, lay it on us.
So basically, the short version of the story is the British decided that they were going to take over America again, 1812. And they had a really good shot at it. They burnt down the White House. They, you know, mm-hmm. conquered all these cities. They took over the East Coast. Their navy was just sort of floating up and down the East Coast. And they decided that all they had to do is sail up the Mississippi, and with a land invasion, they could push the Americans into the ocean and, you know, and take us back, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there were a bunch of reasons for that. You know, they weren't the only bad guys in this situation. So the last city standing was New Orleans. They had to get past New Orleans in order to sail up the Mississippi. And so what they did is they amassed this armada of, the ton of ships and 20,000 soldiers. And they're coming to attack New Orleans by surprise. And their mistake that they made is there's a group of pirates that had built this little pirate island south of New Orleans where they were running the smuggling operation. And so they're keeping New Orleans, you know, flush with rum and silk and rugs and everything by raiding ships in the Pacific and then smuggling them through the swamps from their little pirate island. And the city of New Orleans was kind of like winking at it, you know?
Yep.
So the British came to the pirates and said, hey, we'll offer you $2 million to guide us through the swamp to surprise attack New Orleans. And the pirates said, sure. And then they turned around and they told the city of New Orleans, because, you know, they're pirates. And so the British show up and the city's ready. And basically it was 20,000 soldiers against 3,000 of the most ragtag defenders you ever saw. So the only people they could call to get there in time, the only person they could call to get there in time was Andrew Jackson, this militia commander from Tennessee. So he brought 1,800 hunters with their hunting rifles to come join this group of lawyers and whores and free slaves that they promised to pay. And then like 82 Choctaw warriors. And they said, Jackson, you need to, you know, gather these guys up and defend the city. Good luck. You're going to die. 7-1 odds. And so after the pirates betray the British, the lawyer of the pirates, who's basically like the Saul Goodman of the 1800s, Breaking Bad, he shows up to Andrew Jackson and he's like, hey, my client has a lot of cannons. And Andrew Jackson is like, no, I don't deal with pirates. And he's like, well, he has a lot of cannons and you're going to need it. So he's like, okay, fine. So the head of the pirates becomes a co-strategist for this defense. His name was Jean Lafitte. It's like one of my favorite characters in history. So basically, between the two of them, they get this army to defend the British. So the British show up with their 20,000 troops all lined up in those rows, you know, kind of like I was talking about earlier.
Right.
And they basically, all these groups taught each other their different fighting tactics. And so the Choctaws taught the hunters, who, you know, they were ostensibly enemies at this point, taught them how to do guerrilla warfare. The pirates and the free slaves made friends. And in fact, after this battle, they, like a bunch of them, all moved to their own island and started their own colony, which is kind of awesome, after if Jackson didn't pay them.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, I know. He's the only president in history to stiff his contractors. So the pirates, basically took their pirate cannons and manned these ramparts out of dirt that they made. They floated a ship down the river and started, you know, shooting at the ground troops with these cannons that were not doing a terrible amount of damage other than to just really dampen the spirits of this British army.
Hmm.
Meanwhile, these Indian warriors and these hunters basically murdered everyone who stepped out into the woods to pee. And this was not denting the army. It was just like really demoralizing everyone. And so finally the, you know, the British were like, all right, we got to attack. And they went to attack. And, well, first they sent an emissary to Jackson and said, would you please, you know, just fight us like honorable men. And Jackson sent an emissary back and he said, no. And, and so they basically, they line up their troops and they're like, all right, we're just going to run over these guys and, you know, we'll have some casualties, but this is what's going to happen. And so they went to march to battle, and these Tennessee hunters with their slow, long-range hunting rifles, they did what you're not supposed to do in war, which is they just shot all of the generals on top of their horses.
That's right.
And you're not supposed to do that. Everyone knows that. They just fought with Napoleon. Napoleon didn't do that, but these guys did. And basically, the long story short is this group of people, including the, you know, the contingent of whores, they all banded together and combined their different heuristics and ideas and perspectives. They lost 333 people.
That's it.
And the British, yeah, and the British lost 3,500 in the first assault. So 10-1 casualties, and yet they had 7-1 odds against them. And basically the British were like, no, this is stupid. And they went home, they saved America, and New Orleans threw a party. Jackson didn't pay anyone, and so, you know, the pirates and the free men of color started their own colony on some island. And here we are today with America. So,
hold on. What happened to the whores?
You know what? I think that they just went back to being local heroes. Yeah. They were in charge of the ammunition, and so they basically poured bullets and offered help.
In more ways than one.
Yes. Offered unspecific services, according to historians. So, what I love about this story is I think it's actually a lesson for, you know, kind of what the world needs. But anyone that's working on a project together, the meta lesson here is, you know, Andrew Jackson showed up, and he was like a churlish dude. Mm-hmm. He did not like pirates. He didn't want to deal with them. He didn't want to work with them. He didn't like criminals. He was like a very sort of, you know, hardcore guy. He did not like Creoles. He was sort of a racist dude. You know, he didn't like the citizens of New Orleans, which were this hodgepodge of French and Spanish and everything else. You know, he was not down with these sex workers being part of his army making the bullets. And he was hardly on the right side of history when it came to Native Americans and, you know, as a slave owner and, you know, when it came to Africans. And yet he managed to get all of these people to put aside their difference. And he put aside his ego and differences to defend, to go after this superordinate goal of defending their homeland. And so you might look at this story and say, hey, they managed to get past their differences and a miracle happened. And I would say maybe it was their differences that made the miracle happen. It was their different ways of looking at this problem, teaching each other their own, from their own perspectives and different skills, and combining their tools that they wouldn't have used otherwise. But because they had to come together, that's what made the difference and allowed them to be this sort of amazing team in history. And even though the subject matter is, you know, war and death, and that's awful, it's kind of an inspiring thing to me that you know, we have it in us to get past the things that we don't like about each other, or to work with people that, you know, for whatever reason we don't want to work with. But also, that's exactly who we should be working with. So that's the pirate story, and there's a lot. It gets into, you know, some psychology stuff, and, you know, build on things from there. But I think that needs to be a movie starring Ryan Gosling. Ryan, if you're watching, because I know you're a regular viewer. You know what? I'll work with you on this.
He watches all the time while eating cereal.
Does he?
Yes.
Fantastic. We'll have to peg him on peg him on social on that one. that's a great example, and you're absolutely right. Is that you don't have to have everybody playing from the same page of music to be able to contribute and leveraging other skills and histories and personalities that creates something completely unique. It wouldn't be there if you didn't allow those type of differences in, right?
So let me tell you my nerdy marketing story that can connect this to what I think, you know, a lot of the viewers come to your show for, you know, the how do we do business.
No, they came for the pirates and whores this week.
Well, I'll just leave it there.
Drop the mic.
So when I was an intern at this pay-per-click management company when I was 21 years old, one of the things I was assigned to do was write these ads for our company, so our own pay-per-click management ads for PPC management. And so I'd write these ads on Google. It was early days of Google. I'd write these ads and they did fine. And I'd kind of copy our competitors' ads and they do fine. And it was a sort of race to be like everyone else. Copy the landing pages, and really didn't make a breakthrough in my work there until I started copying online dating ads.
Hmm.
So I actually took online dating ads and like personal ads from Craigslist and in this category of you want to find love, and I just cribbed the text or the cadence or whatever the format of these ads and the landing pages and just swapped in pay-per-click management, ad management. And those ads, were like double the engagement of my other ads.
Right.
And then our competitors started copying my ads, having no idea that I cribbed them from Match.com or whatever. So I think, that kind of lesson, if you're, it's in the vein of teamwork, combining our different ideas and ways of thinking.
Yep.
If you're looking for creative inspiration as a marketer, don't look at your competitors. Don't look in your same vein in your field. Don't look at the best practices because they're about to become average practice.
Hmm.
Look outside of your field and steal cross practices. Take those, those fighting heuristics from the, American Indian warriors and mm-hmm. incorporate those into your strategies. And I think that's how we can sort of tie all this together. But, people say, well, I'm not the creative one, or I'm just going to go with the safe route. We'll go with the safe route by looking at someone who's incredibly successful at what they do in a different industry.
Yep.
And import that. Then you don't have to be naturally creative. In fact, that's how creativity works.
And that's a great idea. And on top of it, you are plugging into another marketing pursuit that is dialed into potentially different emotional hooks that are probably even more attractive than the route that you're in. And again, you gotta assemble it in a way that's not going to be a non sequitur. But at the same time, just borrowing and opening your mind up on not even tangential, just different courses of action from different organizations and brands and stories, right? And be able to pull that in and create something completely different. No, I think it's a great idea. Well, tying this discussion into your other new book, two new books. What the heck, man?
Wasn't on purpose.
Busy, busy, busy. Well, how are great social movements the result of great storytelling?
So the first thing you see when you walk in the office of Contently is this giant mural. It says Native American proverb. It says, "Those who tell the stories rule the world." And I love having that there because one is a reminder that stories are the thing we care about, at Contently. But the other is that this is not new.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like I was talking about with like that bastardization cycle, right? Buzzwords come and go, but underneath a lot of buzzwords, if storytelling is a thing that we're buzzing about right now, underneath that word
mm-hmm.
is a fundamental thing about how humans connect. And so even the ancient Americans, right, knew this, that stories build relationships and make people care. They bring us together. They cause us to want to change. And so, thinking about that through the lens of someone who has an organization that you want to get people to join,
mm-hmm.
right? Whether that's a movement or whether that's a company recruiting or whether that's a company trying to recruit users and customers, the fundamental way that humans build relationships with each other is by building empathy with each other and by spending time together. And stories, it turns out, are a really great way to do both. There's this, so we write about in the Storytelling Edge, and I come back and address it in the social movements chapter of Dream Teams about how there's this neurochemical in our brain called oxytocin that for 100 years, the only thing we knew about it in the medical community was that it has something to do with childbirth. Like mm-hmm. your brain generates a lot of it when you're having a baby and right after you have a baby. And about 10 years ago, maybe a little less than 10 years ago, some neuroscientists discovered that not only that, but actually your brain squirts little oxytocin molecules everywhere whenever you're shown a kindness. Or when someone gives you a hug,
mm-hmm.
or when you have a positive social experience, or by a surprise they learned, when you experience, watch, listen to, or read a story about a human being. And so they actually can put these devices on you now. And I did it recently. They can measure variations in your vagus nerve, which is the nerve that basically it wobbles essentially when more oxytocin is in your bloodstream. And they can actually measure this, and you can watch, you know, a movie or a television commercial or an advertisement or a YouTube video, they do these tests with charities, for example, charity messages, and they can actually measure based on what you're seeing how much oxytocin your brain is generating, and this oxytocin makes you have empathy for the people, and it turns out that empathy will cause you to donate more to charity or to want to do business with, you know, whoever the commercial's about, or, you know, want to go give some person a hug. And it turns out that certain types of stories create more of this. And the reason for it is that, you know, when we were developing as humans and we needed to survive together, we needed to survive because we have great brains but small bodies and we want to beat the saber-toothed tiger, we got to band together. Turns out that if you want to band together, you need to care about each other. Mm-hmm. And that becomes advantageous for your survival. And one of the ways that we learn to care about each other is by telling stories together, by watching someone and having our brain decide that we should feel the same emotions that they do so we can survive together and help them out. And so the upshot is basically that stories that have an emotional component, stories that have characters that we can relate to, either that we see ourselves in or we see someone we know in, characters, villains that we can see ourselves turning into, these are the kinds of stories that get our brains on high alert. And then as we see them experience tension, either their own emotions or, you know, hanging from a cliff's edge, if you're James Bond, they have a gap between where they are and where they want to be, or who they are and who they want to be. We see characters we can relate to experience those kinds of things. Our brains go crazy with oxytocin and we develop this empathy for them. And so as a business person, as a marketer that's trying to get people to care about you and your product and your brand, mm-hmm. telling stories about the humans who are affected by this or who are behind this or who are making this, or the non-human characters that you can relate to in a way that unlocks emotions, that plays with that tension gap between what is and what could be, this is an extremely powerful way to get people to care. And then, you know, insert marketing tactic X, Y, and Z to reach these people with these messages and to capture them and to continue to feed them, you know, these messages so you can continue the relationship. You have a great social experience with someone once, and then they go away. You know, you're not going to have a good relationship 10 years from now, but you have an ongoing great relationship, great social experience. You know, you meet for coffee once a month and tell stories about your life. Guess what? You're going to be fast friends. And so this is kind of the analogy, the obligatory dating analogy for marketing, but that's actually backed by neuroscience. And so the same thing with social movements. I think that, you know, not just in business, any business today has customers that are going to care about who they're doing business with. They want us to be operating businesses that are good for the world, that are being sustainable, that are, you know, doing well and doing good. We want to support those kinds of businesses. But also, if you're trying to start a movement or trying to get people to care about a cause, even outside of business, it's much more effective from a neuroscience and psychology perspective to rally people with the story of a human being that's affected by something or that can be affected by something, then they'll be affected by, you know, the data. So all these charity, experiments where they show, you know, PowerPoint slides and, you know, charts and statistics of all the kids that are dying from, you know, whatever,
right.
Disease and people donate a little bit, but they show the story of the father talking about, you know, his child that has the disease, people will donate three times as much. So I think that's something very human,
yeah.
And stories are a very effective way to unlock that kind of emotion.
Yeah, and you know, marketers tend to not figure that out because, in a lot of ways, it's a little bit more difficult to do that authentic storytelling as opposed to just get linear on the service. And, you know, even in the buyer's journey mindset, they don't use that type of sidelong advocacy and empathy point to be able to connect with our audience, and it's that glue that keeps us together. You're absolutely right. So lesson learned there, and we certainly recommend reading that book. I think every marketer should be a storyteller in a particular manner, right? And not so much the technicians or the tactical marketer that needs to push the buttons and get everything delivered from a distribution standpoint, But even that is, you need to know how to gauge the response as well as you start putting together the storytelling episodes or the storytelling content in the different mediums, the different omni-channel space, right?
Yeah, you know, another dimension of this, I just wrote about this, is if you are a marketer and you're trying to understand your customers, mm-hmm. you know, you can ask them the questions, you can do their user research, user testing, whatever it is. There's that quote, I'm going to get it wrong, but it gets thrown around a lot about how, you know, Steve Jobs says, you know, if I asked people what they wanted, you know, or no, it's Henry Ford. If I asked people what they wanted, they say, you know, faster horse and buggy. And Steve Jobs always talked about how he didn't want to create what people wanted. He wanted to create what they didn't know they want. Mm. And one of the best ways, I think, to actually do that with your customers is don't just ask them your list of questions that you have of, you know, should the button be on the right or on the left, or, you know, what kind of message you want from us. Find out your customer's stories. Understand, you know, their backstory, what motivates them, what drives them, what they care about outside of work.
Absolutely.
And if you can start to do that, then you develop this empathy for them so that then you can put yourself in their shoes and you know better than them, you know, if you're smart about your industry, you know better than them what's going to be good for them at some point. You know, you do the research and all that. But if you know their stories, then you can help anticipate their needs using your combining your subject matter expertise with the empathy and the story that you have of understanding their lives. And I think learning people's stories is a much more powerful way than just going through the motions of customer research. So it takes place on both sides, not just, you know, the marketing messages,
right,
but the way that we build our marketing strategy. And I think even inside, you know, I'm too nerdy about being obsessed with this stuff, but I think even inside of, you know, your marketing team, the people that are working together ought to learn each other's stories. You ought to send them to dinner and, you know, have them talk about their childhoods, not about work, mm-hmm. because you better believe that once you get to know someone at that kind of, you know, personal and emotional level,
yep.
when you have a debate, it's much easier to give that person the personal benefit of the doubt and have the debates remain about ideas rather than get personal and decide, you know what, I don't like Aaron, so screw him. You like Aaron because you can relate to him. You have, you know, that, you know, empathy for him.
Right.
So when you disagree with him, it's not about him. It's about the ideas. And that, I think, also pushes us forward.
Yeah, it's a baseline context of respect and candor. And so it's not, you're not personally yep. offended by the pushback on the idea.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think it applies in all sorts of facets of the way that we do business.
Excellent. Shay, this could certainly beget other conversations. You guys, you're grinding out some great content. Your brand is super strong. How many people work for you over there?
Full-time at Contently, it's 100 and something. Oh, wow. We have a freelance network of somewhere around 100,000 people who have built profiles of, you know, professional journalists and photographers.
Holy crinoli, what's going on over there?
Yeah, I think something like 10% of them are actively working at a given time, which means there's a lot of people available, but it is a massive amount of people.
Very cool.
And so far so good. And, I think we don't consider ourselves only, you know, our staff of 100 and our network of people, but people in the ecosystem like you that are helping us to, you know, to think about shaping this space and, you know, and this industry in the right way. I think we're all part of the same team there.
Absolutely. I appreciate that. Thank you. To wrap up here, we always ask a couple questions of our guests. First and foremost, actually not foremost, but it's first. What bugs you about your industry right now?
When we were talking about it in the pre-show, I filled out this questionnaire about what bugs me, and I couldn't remember which of the things I filled out.
Yeah, you were armed for bear, weren't you?
Yeah, I was.
But the oxytocin kicked in.
You know what? I feel good about everything. what bugs me about the industry, I think, is when people say this is the way it's done,
yep.
and it harkens back to everything that I've been talking about. Right? This is the way it's done is the enemy of innovation, and I think it's easy thinking and it's safe thinking, but it's small thinking.
Absolutely.
So I think we need to ban that from our vocabulary and from our teams. And, the person who suggests something that makes us initially want to say, well, that's not how it's done, that's the person we need to listen to. That's the person we need to import into our thought process. So
unless so they're carrying like a bag of cats or something like that,
or malaria,
or malaria. I like it. I like it. Very good. Well, conversely, what excites you about the industry?
So one of the things I've been thinking about a lot, and that Contently has been talking about a lot, is you know, we're squarely in the content marketing thing. You know, creating content, telling stories, and using that. And content marketing is this term that every interview I do, I get asked, you know, what's the definition of content marketing? And I'm happy to say, I'm excited to say that I don't really care anymore, because what's starting to happen is marketers are realizing that content marketing, you know, has sort of become a euphemism for start a blog. and, you know, and it's sort of this tactic of, you know, long form content or whatever it is. And people have different definitions, but that's kind of a generally accepted.
It's actually very, very slippery if you really get down to it. Nobody can pin content marketing down. But go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So the thing I'm excited about is we're seeing more and more companies not getting so hung up on that definition and sort of that kind of tactical approach and thinking more about it. And analysts are starting to talk about this too, about just sort of flipping that, of marketing with content, using content to power all of your marketing. So, you know, whatever the channel, whatever the new Snapchat goggle AR/ER thing shows up, guess what's going to make it more powerful is content. You know, no matter where you are in your funnel, you know, whether it's raising awareness or whether it's moving pipeline or keeping customers happy and engaged, content can help at any stage. And so it's not all just content marketing, you know, with a channel, with a blog or a podcast or whatever. It's using content to power the whole spectrum of marketing. And I'm seeing a lot more companies doing that. And I think that that's great. That's great news for, you know, any of us who believe in the power of storytelling, but also helping businesses kind of get back to human a little bit. You know, inserting more of that real connection with people along every stage, rather than, you know, great inspiring content, you know, in the blog or YouTube or whatever it is. And then you get to, you know, further down into the funnel, or you start doing business or whatever. And then everything is just, you know, that sort of marketing as usual, that doesn't feel as personal and human. You know, that's starting to change. And that means that I think that companies and the people behind them are going to have better relationships with their customers, and that's going to make everyone happier. So I'm excited about that.
Very good. No, I can appreciate that. Content and different types of content, and repurposing content in different spaces, being more efficient, but also knowing how you have to adjust it based on the destination. You know, that's core.
Yes.
And for consistency's sake, it's you got to meet your audience on their preferred method of consumption when it comes down to the media. You got to know how to say it in their space. It's almost like you're translating inside the UN, right? You got to be able to, you know, Trump doesn't know how to speak Swahili, but you better believe he trusts the network to be able to deliver that message, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's switching from, you know, thinking about marketing with content is about thinking of everyone as an audience, you know, not just users, customers, dollar bills, whatever it is. And so if you're treating someone as an audience, you want to give them what they want, where they want it, rather than sort of leading with what you want, and or having this sort of schizophrenic personality where you're all great on one side and then you're being pushy on the other side.
There it is. Well, Shane, it was certainly a pleasure speaking with you today, and good luck in both of your books. You know, you got such a great success over Contently. However, you've got even a higher degree of success in another vocation. Now, it's very strange that you didn't bring that up when we first started. To all of our audience, Shane was actually part of the Southeast Idaho's number one breakdance crew.
Yep. Six style with one instead of an I.
And that happens to be the only Southeast Idaho's breakdance.
We don't have to bring that up. So my friends in high school and first year of undergrad, we each had one move that we could do, breakdance move. So, you know, circle clears out, you know, on the dance floor. My buddy Brian does a head spin. I'll go do a windmill. Joe, who's actually my co-founder at Contently, he's going to be mad that I'm telling you. He goes in and he does like the jackhammer move or whatever, and everyone's like, wow, these guys are amazing. And then we don't do anything else because we can't do anything else. That was a brief thing that I thought I was going to do with my life.
With one move?
Here we are.
Hey, if you get one move, you take it to the max, man.
Yeah.
Is there anything else, anything we could promote for you contently?
You know what? I mean, we've been talking about all our stuff this whole time. Mm-hmm. My website is shanesnow.com. All of my projects are there, including the books at Contently. You can also get a hold of me if anyone wants to talk about any of this stuff right there.
Go check out the storytellingedge.com. Again, love the title. it's great to be able to hear true focus on content storytelling and the humanistic approach towards marketing. Pleasure speaking with you today. We wish you all the best in the world, and we're certainly interested in getting a couple of those books, and hopefully we can get a signed copy or two at the studio.
Make sure that happens. Yes.
Cool. It sounds that you have been and are on the right track, and you're also teaching a huge network of contributors and your staff of how to do it the right way. So congratulations on that.
Well, thank you.
All right, so for all of our users and listeners, you want to go check out Shane over at his Twitter, Shane's Now, or Shane Snow. Holy crap, did I just do that? On Facebook at Shane Snow, LinkedIn Shane Snow, Shane D. Snow, as well as Instagram, Man Eating Robot. What the hell is that? Excellent. Hey, thanks for listening to Edge of the Web Radio. Special thank you to our colleagues over at Site Strategics and our guest, Shane Snow, not Shane's Now. And make sure to check out all of our must-see videos and insider information over at edgeofthewebradio.com. That's edgeofthewebradio.com. We'll talk to you next week. Yeah, we're done with our shows this week. We'll be coming back around for another guest. Who's on deck?
Ashley Ward from SEM Rush.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. All right. Big favorite tools over here at Site Strategics. Be sure to jump over to edgeofthewebradio.com/ROI for getting that special discount on your digital marketing report. Hey, if you like what you hear here, make sure that you like, share, and also review us, because that helps the gears go around on our podcast. For all of us at Site Strategics and Edge of the Web Radio, thanks so much. Do not be a piece of cyber driftwood. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.